This will be short and sweet. More short than sweet, but short and sweet presentation on currency of relationships. They chose this title because it's apparent contradictory nature. When we think of currency, we think of material exchange, and relationships is not on the basis of material exchange. So if you put these two terms together, it sounds like something that's material and something that's not so material. And pure and impure, this will become clear as we go through the topic. The ideas that are being presented primarily are taken from the teachings of Rupa and Sanatan Goswami. And for those of you that are not familiar with these two personalities, they were Prime Minister and Finance Minister of King Nawab Hussein Shah about 500 years ago in West Bengal. Of course, West Bengal was bigger then than it was now. The whole kingdom of Nawab Hussein Shah is now about one-third of all of India, so it's like the Prime Minister of India, or third of India at the time. Very, very learned. Even before they took up spiritual life, and very capable individuals. They both left their wealth, their position, their influence to live practically like mendicants in Vrindavan under the direction of Lord Chaitanya. And they were the leaders of the Vaishnava community throughout all the land for the duration of their lives. Of the two brothers, the one seated here is Sanatan Goswami. He was elder, and the younger of the two brothers was Rupa. And Rupa, as you see, he's writing. He was a prolific writer, and particularly in the subject of rasa, or the relationships, understanding the nature of the different mellows or humors or different types of loving relationships with the Supreme Lord. The knowledge that he spoke from was directly imparted to him by Lord Chaitanya, and the language of rasa that he used was taken from the portion of the Vedas that deals with drama. Now, modern day drama is very different than Vedic drama. Modern day drama is violence and terror and fear and sex and crime and, you know, things that just jolt your senses. That's modern day drama. And Vedic drama had a very different purpose. It was to awaken deeper feelings, particularly feelings of devotion to God. Prabhupada described that even when he was a little boy, whenever there was some kind of a public presentation, it was always on Ramayana or Mahabharata or something in relation to some great personality done in such a way that the deeper, richer sentiments, spiritual sentiments, would awaken in the audience. It was by design like that. There was a whole science in drama, how to awaken different moods within the audience based upon principles of the science of rasa. So from that Vedic wisdom, Rupa Goswami derived the language to describe the transcendental position of loving the Supreme Person. So I'll give credit as we go along to Rupa Goswami's terms. And of course, knowledge from Bhagavad Gita. So this is really basic, but you'll see why we're doing the real basic thing. We'll start with what is a relationship. And this little definition we're going to refer to several times. The common basis of interaction amongst two or more people. That's a relationship. Common basis, interaction. We'll look at those words. What's common basis? It means there's a commodity of exchange or currency that all parties agree on. Commodity exchange. Look it up on in dictionary or Google and see what it says. I did. And it's an economics term. Commodity exchange. Or commodity of exchange. So, prior to printed paper money, there was exchange based upon something that was considered to be of worth to both parties. Grains for ghee, or some commodity for another commodity, or the bartering system was common. I'll fix the roof on your house if you supply me 3 cows or something. So, and minus that kind of commodity exchange, there's currency. And people agree, or they don't agree. If they don't agree, then there's no deal. There's no common basis. But if they agree, then I'll accept, I'll do this and you do that for some common basis. Without a common basis, there's no way to relate. So, or there's no relationship, or at best a dysfunctional relationship. There's no common basis between two parties. So you have to have a common basis. An exchange implies that in the relationship there's a subject and an object, and the roles alternate back and forth between subject and object. So now we need to define what subject and object mean. But there's an exchange. Object, these folks up here, they're the subjects, and this little baby that you can't see and down in the crib, that's the subject. The object is the person who is acting or is directing feelings towards whom the feeling is being directed. Excuse me. There's the object, the baby in the crib. These are the subjects. They're the ones who are feeling something towards the object. So in a relationship, there's alternating roles. Sometimes one is expressing some feeling for another, and then one's the object and the other's the subject, and it goes back and forth, as in a discussion. And in that exchange, what's the currency? Or the commodity of exchange, the common basis? It's emotion. And following emotion, there's action. You'll see why I'm, hopefully you'll see why I'm going through these terms so carefully. Now comes Rupa Goswami's language put in real simple terms. This emotion, go back, the primary commodity or the currency is emotion. And then emotion has 8 different kinds, according to the science of rasa. There's the primary one, that's love. And then there's secondary emotions that, according to the Vedic literatures that describe the science of rasa, there are 7. Then the mixtures of them. Amazement, humor, chivalry, compassion, fury, fear, and dread. So since all of you except for me are from India, I can give a nice Vedic example and you'll understand how this works. An example of how this works is Grandfather Bhishma. The relationship that Grandfather Bhishma had with Krishna was pure love. And in particular, humor of love that was servitorship. He just wanted to serve Krishna. Let's say that's different than Mother Jasoda. Her relationship was that of a parent. Or the gopi's relationship with Krishna was that as a lover. Bhishma's relationship with Krishna was that of servant. But there were times in their exchanges with one another where the emotion of servant became eclipsed by chivalry. For example, when the five arrows that Bhishma Dev gave to Duryodhan and said, give these to me in the morning at sunrise, and with these five arrows I will kill the five Pandavas. And when Bhishma Dev said something, he kept his word, right? He said, I will not marry. I will not become king. Nor will my son become king because I won't have any children. Took a lifelong vow of no marriage, no contact. And he kept that throughout his life because that's the character of Bhishma Dev. So Krishna made Bhishma Dev break that promise because Krishna reigns through Arjuna to get the arrows from Duryodhana. And when Bhishma Dev came in the morning before Duryodhana, or Duryodhana came to Bhishma Dev, he asked, where are the five arrows? He said, I don't have the five arrows anymore. Arjuna came and asked for charity. And he asked for those five arrows, and so I don't have them anymore. So Bhishma Dev took another vow. He said, very well, Krishna has broken my promise. I'll make Krishna break his promise. By the setting of the sun, either Krishna will break his promise that he will not fight in the battle, or his dearmost friend Arjuna, my grandson Arjuna, will be killed on the battlefield by me. Right? And Bhishma Dev fought so fiercely that it looked like Arjuna was finished. So when the chariot of Arjuna was broken by the powerful arrows of Bhishma, he was off his chariot and Bhishma Dev was ready to kill Arjuna. So Krishna picked up the chariot wheel and began charging at Bhishma Dev. What did Bhishma Dev do? He was in ecstasy. He dropped his weapons and smiled radiantly. Krishna has shown that his promise that he will protect his devotee, I forced him to break his promise that he won't take up any arms and fight in the battle. And just at that moment, the sun was setting and the conch blew, and that was the end of the fighting. So the primary relationship of love was eclipsed by the secondary relationship of chivalry. It's likened to the waves of the ocean. Sometimes the tide will rise. Each day the tide will rise. And that which is beach, which is just sand, becomes covered with water. And then it recedes. So the primary thing is love. And the secondary emotion may cover the primary emotion. And there's so many examples of that in everyday life. Compassion, fury, fear, dread. There's emotions that predominate in some relationship, and when that secondary emotion subsides, the primary emotion is evidenced. So somehow this projector has got a little slice at the bottom. So, anyway, it says love is the primary emotion. And we're going to detail this primary emotion according to the science of rasa. It's five: neutrality, servitorship, friendship, parental and conjugal love. So here's example. We'll see this same picture again, so I'll detail it later. Neutrality, servitorship, friendship is in an ascending order of intensity of affection. Parental affection and conjugal affection. So, summarize, in a loving relationship, the person who loves is the subject, and the person who is being loved is the object. And then, in these five relationships, we're going to look at the character of each of the five kinds of emotion, and then the quality of these emotions. So in neutrality, this is a classroom where there's students lined up, and in some relationship, they're all students together in the same classroom. But there's not any interaction, it's rather neutral, but there's some relation, they're sitting side by side or in a row or something, and it's passive. But supposing one of the students drops their pen, another student picks up their pen and hands the pen, so there's some exchange, some service. Or another one turns to another one and says, I don't know the answer to this question. Can you help me out with the answer to that question? And that's a little service. And then when service becomes more intimate, then that service relationship can become friendship. And in some cases, where there's not only friendship kind of affection, but where one is feeling the necessity to maintain another. It can be like an older brother, younger brother, parent, child, teacher, student kind of relationship. There's an added dimension. Everything that's there in the previous plus maintenance or protection. And then further, in the fullness of surrendering oneself into another is a conjugal relation. So now comes, this is character of love, now comes quality of love. And we might have a little debate on this topic, but here's what these teachings express. There's pure and impure quality of love. What makes that difference between purity and impurity? The assertion, or the definition here, as we've been going through definitions, is the difference is knowing or not knowing the subject or the object, the lover or the beloved. So we'll break this down a little bit. If there's wrong knowledge about the other person, or even oneself, and instead of we identify what the self is not, we identify the self as the body or the mind, what's wrong knowledge, and it results in impure and temporary love. Like the knowledge that we acquire in our modern educational institutions. We'll start with this one. In order to get into a university, those of you that are students, you had to fill out some application. And when you filled out the application, what were the questions they asked? What's your name? What's your address? What's your parents' name? Where were you born? How old are you? Color of your hair, color of your eyes, height. And about the mind. Where did you go to school? What were your grades? What was your GPA before you applied to this school? And things about the body and the mind. And similarly reinforced throughout the whole education process. And certainly the modern consumer society. We went through this when I was here before. Spiritual economics, right? You're not happy unless you're taught through consumer economics that you won't be happy unless you have this product called marketing. If you get this product, then you become happy. So, and those products are in terms of the body. And consumer society is based upon things that are going to make your body happier, or more comfortable, or warmer, or cooler, or sleeker, or trimmer, or slimmer, or more beautiful, or something in relation to the body or the mind. Now, right knowledge, this is a definition that we're going to take a look at. Is this a good definition? Right knowledge is to identify both subject and object as the soul, and even more as the servant of God, leading to pure and eternal love. Where do you get this knowledge? Not in our modern education societies or institutions, not in Walmart or Target, but in scriptures. And it's taught by non-sectarian teachers of those religions. So here's our message here. Pure relationships, there's pure and impure, pure relationships result from knowledge of our spiritual identity. Impure relationships result from ignorance of it. So let's take a look and see if that's true. Can we have pure love from something other than understanding our spiritual identity? Well, our response is no. Knowledge of our identity awakens pure love within us. One follows the other. If we don't have knowledge of our identity, if we're covered by ignorance, knowledge that excludes our identity, everything is relationship-wise and emotion-wise and the end result-wise, it's impure. So the whole world is mainly moving with this other idea of accepting the body as the self. So, does it work? Let's take a look and see if it works. These are some statistics from surveys done. They don't have this year's surveys because it hasn't finished yet, but last year, 2 million in America, 2,200,000 marriages. And their statistics show that one-third of all of those marriages last year are likely to end in divorce within 15 years. There's another statistic that's not here, and that's of those modern marriages in America, the number of divorce is about half of that number of marriages. Of course, those were previous ones. So it's about a 50% rate per year, and the ones that are currently getting married, they'll within 15 years, they'll also not be married or end in divorce. Here's another statistic, the product of marriages, or even relationship between man and woman outside of marriage in America today. There's births. Over 4,158,000 live births. Of those, nearly a million died at the time of birth. That's a big number. And more than that, 1,197,000 were purchased, procured abortions. So that's about a percentage of, 28% of close to a third of every child that's a product of a man-woman relationship doesn't even see the light of day. Pretty big statistic. Then interpersonal dealings, crimes against a person. In the year 2007, in the United States alone, 1,400,000, or the average of 3,800 crimes against a person every day in the United States. Crimes against property, much bigger number, almost 10 million. Or 26,000 plus daily. So people aren't happy with one another in the United States. On college campuses, I don't know how big it is at this university, but here's some research that's been done from Adolescent Medicine, Archives of Pediatrics. There's a thing that they've given a term for it, relationship violence. All forms of relationship violence are prevalent among male and female college students, both. Almost half of the students had experienced relationship violence at some point in their lives. More than one-third had experienced violence before college, and one-quarter had experienced violence during college. So there's probably some percentage of that is just predatory type people that go around trying to hurt one another. but there's no statistic dividing them, but probably most people don't go around looking for relationships so they can hurt other people, but they enter into relationships with a good intention. But over half of the college students interviewed had experienced relationship violence that ended up in a violent affair, a violent exchange with another person, both men and women. So these are just some of many statistics, sociological studies that show that the exchanges of love between one temporary limited body and another temporary limited body is prone to result in temporary limited love. And alternatively, it's reasonable to say that the exchange of love between one eternal powerful soul and another eternal powerful soul results in something quite different. Now, in all of this discussion, there's an important ingredient that isn't necessarily so obvious, and we want to spend some time discussing. That is, how can there be a relationship between two persons when you also involve God? Go the other direction, and what about excluding God from and still have a pure relationship? And according to Bhagavad Gita, that's not possible because God is already present within every living being and within at every atom of existence and in the heart of every living entity. There's a nice verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says that. Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hastini Shuni Chaiva Svapakecha Pandita Samadarshana. There's the Pandita, the learned person. They see with equal vision, Samadarshana, all living entities, whether they be a learned Brahmin, or a dog, or a dog eater, or a cow, or an elephant. They see with equal vision because within every living being there's this spark of life. And the soul or the body is covering, the body is covering that soul, but within the body there's this same spark of life and ultimately the Supreme. So how does it work when you have these different relationships between one soul and another soul and God comes into the picture? Here's how it works. If both the persons, the subjects, make God the common object or the recipient of their actions and their feelings, their love, in serving Him, then in any one of the relationships between one living entity and another living entity, it brings that relationship to the position of pure and natural and a long-lasting relationship. Here's an example. By serving God, it's like pouring water on the root of a tree. And when you pour water on the root of a tree, automatically the water is distributed to all the parts of the tree and branches and twigs and leaves and fruits and flowers, and everything is done very nicely, very naturally, just by placing the water in one source. Similarly, if we can find the root of all existence and we place our service and our affection and our emotion and our love there, automatically all the parts of the tree of life become nourished. So here's a little diagram. We've called it the relationship circles. And in the relationship circles, God's at the center. And there may be people who are guiding us in our lives that we hold very dear and near to us. And then in turn our family and extended family and society in general But in all the cases of all those different types of relationships with God at the center, then it makes whole all those relationships. And here's a nice little example. This example is especially important to me because it's the first, this example was given by Prabhupada, the first lecture I heard him speak. In fact, I can distinctly remember that I couldn't understand what he said, so I had to go back and hear it 4 or 5 times, the recording of the lecture, because I was new and Prabhupada was new in the country, so his accent was something I couldn't clearly follow. But I listened to it very carefully, and here's what he said. He gave an example. Made a motion like this, like a pond in the middle of our floor here, in our space. And imagine giving everybody present a small pebble. And then somebody was asked among the group, okay, throw your pebble into the water. Let's see what happens. And this is what happens. A little splash. Boop. And then concentric circles expand from where the pebble hit the water. And it's very nice. Very geometrically symmetrical. Very nice. And then somebody else. Okay, you place your pebble in the water and let's see what happens. And that's what happens. You get 2 circles, and the circles are fine until the circles intersect, and then you get some clash. And that's invariably what happens when you have relationships without the same center. You have a conflict. Then we were to, supposing we were to say on the count of 3, everyone at once, place your pebble in the water. What happens? The whole surface of the water is disturbed. Then Prabhupada went back to this. Supposing we all agreed, we'll have one common place where we'll place our pebble. And we all place our pebble in that common place. And it's very nice, not only concentric circles expand that don't clash, but they amplify one another. So in this way, if we can find that root of the tree or the common source that is the common basis amongst all of us, that from which all of us come and derive our existence and repose our individuality there, we can preserve and maintain and fully express our individuality and it still be complementary to others' individuality. Then a little side remark. Supposing you don't know what's that common center of everything. About 3 weeks ago, I met somebody like that. Somebody that was on a train that was going from New York to Harrisburg. And after that, I was planning to go to our farm in mid-Pennsylvania, Gitanagari. So somebody sat down in the seat next to me. There was a packed train, so it was a middle-aged lady, and she sat down, busied herself doing her thing, and after some time turned to me and said, are you part of a religious organization? I was dressed, you know, my dhoti and tilak, and I said, yes, I'm part of a religious organization. And then she said, a curious next question was, are you going to be visiting one of your communes? And I said, well, yes, a community, a spiritual community. She said, yes, a spiritual community. I lived in a spiritual community, a commune in West Virginia long ago. I said, really, what kind? She said, it was a macrobiotic community. And those of you that don't know what macrobiotic is, it was a trend during, you know, the 60s and 70s where a kind of ism, a kind of belief that said you should only, for health and wealth and, you know, good well-being, spiritual well-being, you should only eat foods that are locally, indigenously grown and in season. and there's only a certain way they should prepare them. So it's a macrobiotic diet. It was part of a spiritual path. So I said, what happened? She said, well, the commune fell apart. I said, really, what? Why did it fall apart? Because the people who came there for that original common purpose, they started getting different ideas of what it should be, and, you know, slowly people left, and so I left too. That center that we all agreed on originally drifted, and then it became chaos instead of unity. You can't just go pick some common center. That's called an ism. And there's lots of isms floating around that people huddle around and they get excited about for some period of time, and then it starts to move. And that which brings people together doesn't hold them together anymore. And then you get this instead of the desired one center. So does it matter if this idea of God is that which is our real root existence? Does it matter which one you pick? And in one sense, from the teachings of Rupa Goswami, it doesn't matter. But there are some essential root understandings that or concepts that must be common. Here's one. Our real identity is not this body, not the covering of the soul, but the soul itself. What the body is but a dress of the soul, and amongst all souls, there's one supreme, God. And that supreme God is supreme because he's the creator, and he maintains all. One of the Shruti mantras says like that, Nityo Nityanam Chaitanas Chaitananam Eko Bahunam. Yovidadati Kaman. There's one Eka amongst all eternals, plural. There's one supreme eternal. Amongst all conscious beings, there's one supreme conscious being, and that one supreme conscious being is maintaining all the others. Since he's maintaining all the others, he's the master, and our natural position is to act as his servant. So whatever the language is, or the culture is, or the religion is, as long as these basic understandings are there, then one can have pure relationships. So these are some understandings that are derived from Rupa Goswami's teachings, the science of rasa, and the message of Bhagavad Gita also. Because from Bhagavad Gita, once you get onto the platform of the soul, it takes away all sectarian views and racial views and ethnic views and all sorts of other things that divide people, and helps us come to the platform of pure relationships where there's genuine love established in that pure relationship with one another. And this is our conclusion. The conclusion is there's a little video clip that a devotee made. It's specifically in relation to Krishna consciousness, but we can move it out of the relation of the specific organization and say when it's principle centered, it can help us move to pure from impure relationships. With different audiences, this means something different. The idea is to bring our attention to the practical value of applying the teachings of Bhagavad Gita in our life. As I move around, I see even big billboards advertising banks saying where the right relationship means everything, come to our bank. It's marketing because people value the right kind of relationships. It's a current area where people are they value very much having the right kind of relationships. The message is, without moving those relationships to the platform of the soul, that is, understanding ourselves and those persons who we are in relationship with on the platform of the soul, it's not going to be a wholesome relationship. But, you know, who identifies persons in they have relationships with on the platform of the soul, we identify on the platform of the body. age or gender or race or nation or so many things on the platform of the body or the mind. Someone is smart or not so smart, and so on. There's natural things like attracts like, even on the physical plane. But we to sustain real value in those relationships, they must move to the spiritual platform. Then they're lasting and wholesome and satisfying. The other, huh? And bringing God into the center of those relationships is ideal. So any discussion? Questions on this? Yeah?
We have discussed about how we could get all the religions into God-centered life. We have discussed a couple of points like the identifying with the soul, not the body. And that's the common ground for all the forces. But how do you get atheists or to accept God and the central focus on God?
Your question is how to get who to accept God?
Atheists.
Yeah. How to get atheists to accept God?
Or anything central, any central point, maybe.
Well, that, atheists by nature is they're opposed. There's varieties of atheists. Fortunately, contemporary studies show that largely people believe in God. So that's our primary, target audience. Not persons who are fixed in their disbelief in God. There's many other people that are kind of like borderline, they're not sure. I had some interaction with a group like that on 1 week ago, Friday, at Detroit Fisher Mansion. It was a one-piece preliminary to a big convention center peace event, and side by side with me at the speaker's platform was a gentleman who is a Gandhian Buddhist from Lanka and has a worldwide organization of service to humanity without any conception of God, without any conception of the soul. He doesn't even exactly call himself, a spiritual man, or his organization is a spiritual organization. It's a service organization. But it has a lot of Buddhist terminology like, nonviolence and respect of the life, respect for life. So, how to move those people? I mean, I don't think I could move that fellow because he's deeply involved in the convictions that he has. But in the audience are persons that were appreciating what he's doing because of, in his own language, philanthropy, with a Gandhian notion of helping others, distributing wealth, and so forth. Indigenous cottage industry and communities that just serve one another on no basis of God, just serve one another, help one another. Because that's our common, anyway, without this whole philosophy. But there were people in the audience that made the connection very clearly. Without that clear understanding of the soul and the root of all existence, God, that may go on for some time, but it's not going to endure. Nor is it going to satisfy, and therefore it won't endure. It brings, in the man was describing you know, the condition in Lanka today is so violent that people just move around in gangs and murder other people and other groups that are, you know, their gang is against. It's, you know, it's a life risky place just to live. So doing what he does, he was giving examples, gave one example of, you know, somebody who was with a gun pointed ready to kill him for doing what he does. For, you know, not a good reason. So, for such a person, for such a teaching, there's no ultimate shelter. There's no ultimate protection. There's no ultimate master that one is serving, other than an ideal. So it's not satisfying to the individual. So how to convince? There were persons in the audience that were. Well, one example was a man that was right in the front row with his wife. They're older, well-to-do, well-educated American people that were mainly his following here in America. They like the Buddhism thing because they don't have to surrender to anybody. They just have to, you know, like to help other people. So when he was listening to the other speaker, although he was seated in a chair, he had his whole body posture like a Buddhist meditation pose with his hands like this, and you know, he was concentrating on what the other speaker was saying. And when I was speaking, he was leaning forward in his chair, going like this. He was also attentive, but it was his body language was he was getting it. And his wife was a little less, you know, body language, but she was nodding also. So in one sense, that could, you know, something like that, that's a mode of goodness type of expression that doesn't have a God concept, it's not difficult to add a God concept in that fertile ground. And other than that, there are lots of people moving around that aren't atheists overtly, but they really don't have shelter in a concept of God. And to offer a very clear concept of God and a clear concept of the soul, thoughtful people appreciate it very much. And finally, one of the most compelling things is what was shown at the end of that little video clip, and that's where there's actually a group of people who are living that life, and they're a visible expression of that shelter. A little example of that sharing. After I went to Harrisburg, I made it to State College, and we had, after our Japa retreat, we had another little retreat there. And there were students from Penn State who came for it was advertised as a mantra yoga retreat. They somehow didn't read the word mantra, they just read yoga retreat. So they came with their yoga mats and their yoga clothes and ready to do yoga. So when we had our orientation on Friday evening, it was mantra yoga. And they were perceivably uncomfortable. Like I felt this wave of energy, like, what's going on? Or, I'm getting out of here. It's only an hour away to go back to State College. I'm out of here. One of them turned to another student and said, is this about God? And it was one of the students with the club that said, well, you said, I didn't know how to answer her question. I just said, well, it's something spiritual. So they were obviously not seeking shelter with God. They wanted, you know, a yoga weekend. That's what they thought they were going to have. We did some questions and, you know, around the room and asking what were your expectations. So we heard what their expectations was. We just hit the reset button and made a different program. It was a yoga, you know, got up late and before breakfast it was yoga before breakfast, and then it was breakfast, and it was yoga after breakfast, different kind of yoga after breakfast. And more yoga, you know, just like flowing yoga. Vinyasa yoga, there was even a name for it. You know, instead of just sitting in a pose, you move and you do vinyasa yoga. And so they got yoga'd up, they were really happy. Then it was lunch, and then pranayama, to make the mind peaceful. How does pranayama work, and how does the air movement work, and how it makes the mind peaceful. So they did some pranayama. I wasn't there for the whole thing. And then at the end of the pranayama session was om. So after you breathe in and exhale, and breathe in and exhale, and then the third one was okay. On the exhale, it's chant. Oh, these are American kids that never had done anything like this before. It was, the exercise was an ocean of om. And they were floating in the ocean of om for a while. They were omed out. They were very, very happy. It fit in very naturally with yoga, pranayama, and then om. And then little presentation. So just step by the best. I can detail. It's nice, but it's just step by step, taking persons to a position where they felt they had entered into a spiritual place within their own consciousness. They hadn't come for that purpose. I'm addressing, you know, first, they weren't atheists, but they weren't seeking God either. They weren't opposed to God, but they didn't want to be, you know, spend time with God. They wanted to do yoga. At the end, went from, you know, what is sound and what does sound do? It was sound moves matter, and sound moves the mind, and sound moves the heart, and sound can take you to a spiritual place if you know the science of sound. And then they were taken through an exercise of feeling in the body the effects of sound. Cathedral of sound. The body is a cathedral. And Pema Trungati led them through that exercise. And at the end, they felt it. They understood it, they felt it, and then it was japa. Then it was prasadam. Then after prasadam, it was the same thing we did the previous night. It was mantra yoga. And now they were very happy to chant Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya in different mantras, and very slow and melodious, and they weren't, you know, they weren't uncomfortable. They were very comfortable. And after some time, by the Hari sense, they were absorbed. And then the tempo picked up. And as the tempo picked up, it got lively. And as it got lively, they looked at each other and got up and started dancing. Then the whole room was people dancing. They had never seen devotees dancing before. They just did it naturally. You know, and in circles and around and whoop-de-doo, like peacocks. And then when that was over, they wanted more. So more was very calm, closing, serene, peaceful, very nice melody. And he was chanting Hare Krishna. These same people that was, you know, oh, is this about God? And they were chanting, and they were very happy. And, you know, round of applause and hoots and hollers. You know. And then the sharing the next day was people saying, in essence, I found this sacred space. I found this place where I could go and just feel very happy. One shared that I have an anger problem. Not really terrible, but sometimes, you know, something happens and my mind sticks on that something that happens that disturbs me. And then once my mind sticks on that something that happens that disturbs me, it just stays there. It won't go away, and it gets bigger and bigger, and I have all these feelings I don't like at all. I don't know what to do with it. But now I know what to do with it. Just take those feelings, put them on the shelf, and go and do my yoga. Chant my mantra. Go into that sacred space. And then I can go address with that thing that, you know, is bothering me. But I can do it in the right way, not in all that ugly way, etc. So a how-to depends on, you know, the persons, but allow them to experience what that higher happiness, inner happiness, the place where the soul resides, invite them in a way that they can accept it and experience it. And just in our everyday life, be that kind of person yourself. The most powerful instrument is purity. That's what Prabhupada taught us. Purity is the force. So by purity, it can attract souls that may not have strong conviction one way or the other into a nice, happy place. So they're willing to explore more deeply, even if they don't know what it is. Yes?
I have another question.
Okay.
Imagine like, let's talk about relationship only, in your examples. If two people, they raised in totally different environment and different culture.
Okay.
And how would we, you know, explain the same thing? Like, how could they face the same problem? Because if they're raised in totally different environment, then it would be really difficult to have one God into center.
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah. The last part of what you said, there'll be, with cultural differences, it'll take some time to learn to be accepting of another individual. And their ways of doing things, and the cultural way of expressing an emotion or a feeling. But there's challenge involved in all of that. What mind is going to is a devotee that I know in Houston. She's a doctor. Indian girl from Fiji, and she married an American husband. And in one sharing session like we're doing now, she shared, you know, that what she was sharing was, I believe, our community, which in the Houston temple is largely Indian families, we need to be reaching out more to our host culture here in America. She said, just like in my marriage, and her husband was there, she said, there's challenges in the differences of culture. But it's made me appreciate more how universal Krishna consciousness is. Because the place where we relate is on the platform of the soul. And on the platform of the soul, we've come to accept one another's differences. And we're happy with one another's differences. It's not my happiness is because we're similar. Our happiness is because, culturally, our happiness is because, you know, I see quality and character in my husband that expresses itself in a very different way than I would express. And I appreciate it. Because it's coming from the soul. And, you know, he may say the same thing about myself. Right? My way of expressing myself is different than how he would express himself. But where is it coming from? And that's our common basis. And it's very relevant, you know, taking specifically you all who are from India, living here in America, you could just stay to yourselves and be happy because there's cultural similarities, and that may or may not help you get to the platform of the soul. But if you want to go to the platform of the soul, then being in a mix of culture may help, especially if the souls who you're interacting with are on the, you know, their consciousness is spiritual, are on the platform of the soul. And then there can be relationship. You know, my life is an expression of that. I mix with people of all different, you know. Even here in America, largely, our congregations are Indian. It's not how I grew up. But it's not a problem of relationship. If it goes to a deeper level. And if it goes to a deeper level, the relationship is more binding than just because there's cultural similarities of how we were brought up. So, back to that definition at the very beginning, there has to be a common basis. If the common basis is bodily similarities, it's not enduring, or even more explicitly, it's not pure. It's not with a clear understanding of who the other individual is. We may be able to relate to their cultural experience and how that cultural experience is like my cultural experience. And that's the basis of the bond. Well, we still don't know who the person is. Nor they necessarily understand who they are. Nor we necessarily understand who we are. So it's incomplete. It's not fully satisfying. It's far more satisfying if it's on the platform of the soul and there's an understanding and relating to the person on that platform. So some adhesion, some glue is needed. But it can be acceptance as the initial adhesion.
So basically, both entities should understand each other at the platform of soul rather than...
Yes, that's the message. And if we're... Sorry to use the tired expression, but if we're spiritual beings, because spiritual can mean so many things to different people, but spiritual in the sense of striving to get to that platform of that which is enduring and eternal. If you have two individuals that are like that, cultural likeness is good, but cultural likeness isn't the adhesion. It's not the attraction between one and another. And nor is it going to be that which is enduring. You find people from the same culture as hating each other for all kinds of reasons, ideological reasons even, family reasons, money reasons. You know, somebody said something hurtful and so that's it, I'm not talking to you. One devotee from South India was just sharing this same thing with me 2 days ago. He said something in an exchange with his father that his father stopped talking to him and has not spoken to him for a year. They certainly have cultural likeness. And it's, you know, it's disturbing to the father and disturbing to the son, but you know, they both have the reasons why they are maintaining the position they're maintaining. It's not on the platform of the soul. So come to that platform is the message. And there's a means, which was the prior question. Yes?
Maharaj, in these times when most people look upon, like you said, that if God is the center, then they will not, you know, we can have concentric circles and people can coexist in harmony. And in these times, you know, when this point is raised, then it, you know, raises eyebrows because people are fighting over religion and God. So how would you comment on that?
My comment is then it's lip service and not from the heart. Because when persons develop that kind of enmity and animosity for one another, it's not on the platform of the soul or the platform of God. It's a platform of the body, you know, in various ways. I mean, examples are not difficult to point to. This party this individual or group of individuals feels our conception of God is superior. And that group feels their conception of God is superior. And stop pushing your conception of God on our conception of God, because our conception of God is superior. And you know, stop bullying us, or we're going to fight back. And they fight back. And that brings more fighting from the other side, because we're right. Look at what these other people are. It's not on the platform of God. It's on the platform of false ego. Misconception of God. And so therefore, conception of the body. Our way is right. That's not a spiritual position. Or say it in a different way. Here's something that Prabhupada taught during the Vietnamese War era, when people would say, Dharma Yudha. You know, people could say there's a principle of religion for fighting. And so won't your idea of, in Bhagavad Gita, just promote more war, religious war? Prabhupada's reply was, that since the time of the Kurukshetra battle, there has not been a religious war. In the name of religion, so many wars are there on the platform, on the basis of aggression and control and exploitation, under the name of religion. So, because people use the name of God or the name of a religion to justify their aggressiveness, it's given religion a bad name, but it doesn't mean that therefore you throw God out. You throw out the abuse. And check the tendency for quarrel on such platform. This is the age of Kali, or the age of quarrel. We should check that. There's many things to say on that topic.
What would you say, Maharaj, would be the basis of coexistence, knowing that there are so many religious faiths with differences in, subtle differences in...
Well, my thoughts were going to this experience last Friday. Seated next to me was a man who was taking people down a path of depriving them of what the human form of life is meant for, God realization, in the name of philanthropy. So I could have easily gotten into an argument with the man right in front of everybody. Easily could have been in that. So rather take that which the other individual has to offer and see if one can, in a respectful manner, elevate it to a higher platform. At least I chose that approach, the Bhakti Vinod Thakur approach, as opposed to the Bhakti Siddhanta approach of humble persuasion, encouraging, see things in a God-centered way on the authority of Scripture. Humble persuasion on the authority of Scripture. And by showing by character, this is what that looks like. That's one method. At least in that particular case, that's the method I chose to apply. Without compromise of message or principle. I think by the end of the evening, the persons who were there, who had no prior understanding of what is Krishna consciousness, they at least had a clear understanding of the difference between what the two speakers are representing. And then they could make their own choices, just as Krishna does in Bhagavad Gita. he provided message to Arjuna and said, now deliberate and do what you feel you must do. So in little bullet points, the responsibility of devotees of the Lord is to be pure and present the teaching of pure knowledge and set that example for the world. Be, live, and speak. That position of purity. Anything else? Our student group here?
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
Yes.
Is it appropriate to live by the example? Doesn't matter what. Then, like, try to, like, I'm trying to say, like, try to force it, but I don't want to use the word force, because that's too strong a word.
Inflame?
Huh?
Yeah, inflame?
Maybe that.
What's
is
the word?
Is it much more appropriate to lead or to live by the example? Or
then
preach. Yeah, this is a general question.
Okay.
Just a lifestyle question.
Okay. Well, your question specifically is it more appropriate?
Yeah.
Here's what one response that Prabhupada gave. In that regard, his response was, if a man that can see is walking down a road and sees a man who is blind and heading for the ditch, if he's a gentleman, he has to do something. Say something. Hey, you're headed for the ditch! Or go and help him from ending up in the ditch. Because he can't see. It's not like, you know.
How do you determine that that person can see or not?
Well, I've been listening to a series of lectures where Prabhupada is addressing this in a very simple way. And his simple standard is from Bhagavad Gita, one who understands God. Like this gentleman next to me, who has a worldwide organization and a lot of followers, and he's, you know, doing a lot of work to help a lot of people. And he's doing a lot of work. It's, you know, it's good, wholesome philanthropy. What would help his followers and him as a teacher is to get the message that there is an origin and source of all things. And we should apply our service, because that's his orientation of service, to that origin and source of all things. So, you could say, you know, that's not just living my life by that example, but it's sharing that message. And it was done in a respectful manner. It wasn't a confrontational manner. But the juxtaposition of the two was also clear. Wasn't forcing anything or deriding him or naming, you know, bad naming him or finger pointing or something. It was just giving the message along with the life example. So it was certainly done in a respectful manner, and it was appropriate, and I think beneficial. Even if he and the persons in the room who, I think he got the message. He didn't agree with it. But he got the message, and some other people in the room got the message, and then they can do with it what they'd like to. And it made me think that by that time spent with this gentleman, I think I gained a something valuable. One something valuable is how dynamic his organization, how dynamically his organization has grown, because he got down into the, you know, the nitty gritty of what people's needs are, and he helps supply those needs on, you know, the village by village basis. So there's, and I shared this with the publicly, there's a friend of mine, a sannyasi, Bhakti Raghava Swami, who's from Canada, who is trying to promote this around the Varnashram model of creating a sense of God-centeredness in village communal life. It's very attractive. This man is, man is attracting lots and lots of, he was sharing with us how many millions of dollars during the tsunami thing he was given. Of course, devotees were also given, but the end result was, we want the end result to be God consciousness. Not only that people have new homes and their wells are restored and whatever else.
Like that.
And that you can say that is preaching, but you know it's serving others in a way that brings God consciousness not just into your own life but in service to others, God consciousness.
And that's what I was thinking, that maybe he's not to that level, but he's still in service. Maybe it's still serving people.
Sure.
A form of relationship that you just talked about.
Sure. Well, he didn't have a conception of the soul, unfortunately. But rather than focusing on that one individual, it's the principle of sharing, which you could say preaching is a stronger word, but sharing your view with another, rather than just living your view, you share your view with another. That's good. Especially if that message is scripturally based and, you know, authentic and, you know, the real deal. If it's a pure message coming from disciplic succession, then it's going to have value. So you have something of value, you share that something of value. So it's not forcing it upon anybody, it's offering something of value. Can enrich the lives of others and take them to another level. That's good.
But again, Maharaj, like if we draw some analogy, for example, I'm a subject and I see an object,
yeah,
and I see that the object is suffering, I can easily correlate that if I do this and this thing for that object, it will make him either solve the problem or it will make him happy. Rather than if I compare it, like it will make God happy if I do search for that object.
Okay, then let's. I like that example. Here's how Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur has depicted that which you just described. Because this is, you know, the pure is knowing who the object is. If the not knowing who the object is soul, it's likened to seeing a drowning man and going and saving the coat of the drowning man. But then the drowning man still continues to drown. You've done a good deed. The burden of that coat is now relieved from him. But he's still drowning. If the root of the problem of material existence is forgetfulness of our spiritual identity and our relationship with the Supreme, that's the root of the... If that understanding is clear, that I want to serve that object, that other person. So along with helping him with the problem that he has. He, you know, he just got hit by the tsunami. He has nothing to eat, and there's no medical attention and no education. And so, to go in and help them establish those things, that's good. Help them solve that problem. But now the deeper problem is, you know, the problem of material existence. According to the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita, one of the items of knowledge that Krishna presents to Arjuna in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita is janma, mrityu, jara, vyadi, dukkha, dosha, anudarshanam. The problems are birth, death, disease, and old age. The soul is caught in that cycle of birth, getting diseased, getting old and dying, and then again birth, and cyclically, that problem is not addressed by not knowing the person as a soul. So help solve problems to their final conclusion. That's the best service. Minus that best service, it's impermanent. Good intention, but good intention is not good enough. That's it. But take that same interest of service and repose it upon the soul. When you repose it upon the soul, the needs of the body and the needs of the mind will also be attended to.
How do you take that in practice?
Communities that care for one another. You know, people that have relationships with one another, where the children, the elderly, education, economics, emotional needs are served by the community. But God consciousness is the basis and support of it all. Minus the God consciousness is the basis and support of it all. It's not satisfying. It's not pure. It's, you know, the relationships can break if I'm not satisfied with what the other person is doing.
How do you differentiate a person with a soul consciousness, something like that, who is helping person, and somebody who is also helping person but without the consciousness? How do you differentiate?
Well, this is a similar question as before. What's the basis between a spiritual and not spiritual person? That basis is knowing God. That's the example that Prabhupada gave. It's right from Bhagavad Gita. The difference, just like, you know, Sura and Asura, the divine and demoniac nature, there's a whole chapter of Bhagavad Gita dedicated to that. Yudhisthira, one of his lamentations was, why do I have to be king? Duryodhana is doing a good job. He's a good administrator. Everything is going on nicely. So let him be the king. It's okay. He let him be the king. But Krishna didn't want that. Why didn't Krishna want that? Because he wanted to leave the world with a pure soul at the leadership. So it's not just a matter of giving things to people and organizing things nicely. That God consciousness needs to be. That's the criterion, the dividing place. Because with minus the God consciousness, someone can be a good administrator, but also diabolical. As was Duryodhana and as are contemporary people who, in the name of this nation, or that nation, or this group of people, that group of people, just exert their power for control and exploitation. And it could be in the name of, you know, to preserve godliness, because otherwise it's barbaric. But the other people look at what that same person is doing as barbaric. But minus God consciousness, that dissension is going to always be there. But
how does the other person know? Because if there is a friction, you said, that other person doesn't
know. Well, the answer to that question. Arjuna asks that question in a couple places in Bhagavad Gita. By what symptoms is the self-realized person known? Or another place in the 14th chapter. What are the symptoms by which is someone who is beyond the modes of nature? And most importantly, how do they get there? So there are symptoms. And the symptoms are scripturally based. So when anybody, at any time of history or, you know, from any culture or background, can evaluate based upon those symptoms. It's not a matter of ism. It's a matter of symptoms. Like, you know, if an Ayurvedic physician takes somebody's pulse in India, they have the same capacity of taking the pulse in any part of the world and tell what the symptoms are. Oh, this is your doshas, and so you've got a pancreas problem, or you've got an arthritic problem, or whatever it is. I can tell from the symptoms. So the symptoms of consciousness are exhibited in behaviors and speech and temperaments. So one who's God conscious, it can be understood by symptoms. And also by speech, just, you know, listening to this doctor speak, it was very clear. There's no shelter in God. Otherwise, shelter in God, that would have been prominent. It was not there. You know, he described when somebody had him at a gunpoint, and his thoughts didn't go to God. And that was not his message to the people. When you're confronted with some challenge of life, you take shelter in God. That's not him. So his speech was indicative of, is God at the center? And so it's not a matter of culture. It's by symptoms.
How does one realize themselves? If they have God at the center, or
they didn't get there? Well, I'll give two very common sense things. What do you do with your leisure time? And when there's danger, where does your mind go? Two very simple things. You have discretionary time. You're just sitting there. You finished your whatever, your day's work. Where does your mind go? What is it that you're that's sheltered, meaningful? In Vedic language, there's prescribed duty, there's emergency duty, and there's discretionary duty or act work. You must do this in emergency. That you just put all your regulative things deciding to deal with the emergency. The house is on fire. You deal with emergency. And then when you have some discretionary time, what do you do with that? What do you like to do with that? What is that shelter for you? Your happiness. And when confronted with some life-threatening thing or dangerous thing or challenging thing even, where does your consciousness go? Where do your thoughts go? And there are symptoms of one who's fixed, as you can understand within yourself and within another. Like Maharaj Ambarish, when the fiery demon sent by Durvas Muni came, the Bhagavatam describes both. His feet didn't move and his mind didn't move. He's a Kshatriya. You know, even if without thinking, something's flying at your face and you protect your face and your eyes blink. It's involuntary. He didn't do that. And his mind didn't change. His thought was, I've offended a Brahmin and I'm getting what I deserve. Here it comes. I accept it. My shelter hasn't changed. And his shelter is offer it. So it doesn't mean, you know, when something is flying at your face, you don't protect. But where are your thoughts going? Someone says something harsh, cruel, and insulting. Where do your thoughts go? You can be angry at that person. Or it can be something else. It can be, you know, some compassion. This person must be really suffering. This just happened. You know, one devotee was sharing. Somebody said something very mean and nasty. Now, what do I do in that circumstance? My response was, just consider. What you did was an act of kindness, and they misunderstood it, and they became angry. How much suffering that other person must be undergoing for the reaction to be like that. So it becomes compassion instead of, what? They said this, well... We discussed this with in Detroit, the Shamantaka jewel store. Even Krishna was criticized. Falsely criticized. Even Krishna in Dwarka. So what did Krishna do? He didn't become disturbed. He just took shelter of the truth and established for the people to see this is the truth. And the person that was the accuser was shamed. But it wasn't like, I want to show this guy, I'm going to... Where's your shelter? What's important for you? So it can be simply values. And... you know, your set of ethics. For some persons, that's very strong, and they just take shelter of their ethics and their values. That's higher than, you know, combat, animal, defense, fighting. But higher than that is sheltering God. And that's one can evaluate oneself internally. And externally, we can see by symptoms that Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita. What are the symptoms of a soul? He specifically says, Arjuna says, how does he walk? How does he speak? How does he behave? How do we understand who is self-realized? Krishna gives very specific answers. Okay.
No, I have one more.
Okay, one more. Go ahead.
But if you apply the same principle on the country level, like, you know, you
see... On the country, on a broad level, you mean?
On the broader level.
Okay.
You know, countries are fighting, and you see...
They sure are.
Country A is abusing country B. They won't, you know...
Yeah, it's not nice.
Yeah.
It's not nice.
Yeah. I mean, they will certainly fight if...
Especially if you're living in country A that's abusing country B.
Yeah.
You feel really bad. So?
I mean, how would we apply the same solutions in that problem?
It's on a national level or a global level, the principle doesn't change. It's, you know, what our capacity to influence may be this, or our capacity may be that, or capacity. So according to capacity, you can influence as much as there's purity. And only as much as there's purity. So at least, I may not have the capacity to influence on a national level. Like, you know, this gets back to his question about preaching. But at least those with whom I'm immediately associating, let me try to be in that let me try, let us try to be on that platform and examples of the real deal, the real thing of being on the spiritual platform in our dealings with one another. Let's try that. That's challenging. Try it. It's challenging. And then act on that platform. And then as you become more expert at acting on that platform of pure relationships, then your capacity increases. Then you can act in a broader circle. And the more there are individuals acting with pure relationships, because that's the message of the title of the presentation, it acts in a broader way. So like one of the students at Penn State, I'll end with this. She said, this is her sharing at the end. She said, I've always thought of myself as being something like an oddball. Like, you know, even my career choice. She's a freshman, American girl, majoring in astrophysics. She said, who majors in astrophysics? So, you know, you're weird, major in astrophysics. And my ideas about life. I also kind of felt, I'm just weird. There's nobody like me. It's just like I'm an oddball. But then to come to this situation and see not only there are others that have the same idea, there's this whole body of literature that presents the same idea, and there's a path to follow where you can get there. She said, I feel validated. I don't feel weird. So, you know, even if there's one such soul that's outside of your, you know, immediate circle, this is on this idea of sharing your ideas, here's a person that there's actually great resonance, and we're providing an opportunity for that one individual and others in different levels, but at least that one individual, a clear path to follow to get to that spiritual space that they can then resonate with others. So that's nice. So, you know, nations, on a very broad scale, Prabhupada's mission, his vision of answering that was massive literature distribution. And through media, allowing people to at least have the opportunity to be exposed to the right idea. The limitation with that is you have to have examples of the right idea. Otherwise, it's not relatable. You follow? It's a nice idea, but, you know, it's too ideal, it's too utopian. That's why that little section. It's not just utopian. There are persons that are actually living that way. Examples. We need more good examples of persons who can live on that platform. Once again, it's challenging to live on that platform because there's so much opposition in the atmosphere that we're moving about, and our conditioning is pretty thick too. But it's certainly possible with pure teaching, right guidance, and, you know, little elbow grease, applying ourselves conscientiously. And nice prasadam helps a lot too. keeps our tanks filled, and we can keep going to the next day. So we'll serve prasadam next. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good group. Very well.